Hi, this is Bill with Kosiaba Fitness, and today I have an interview with a gentleman that just totally blew my mind when I found out about him. Generally, the interviews I provide for you have a lot of good instructional information, educational information, whether it's about training or nutrition or sports, and this interview is purely about inspiration. If after hearing this man's story, you don't get up and go out and do something and reevaluate your life and realize you could do more with it, there's something wrong. Ladies and gentlemen, Mr. Russell Redenbaum. Russell, thank you, Bill. Thank you so much for taking the time to do this with me. Your story starts back a long time ago, and growing up, you lived a relatively normal life as a normal child.
Yes. Okay. Yeah, normal at that time, normal family, four children, Salt Lake City, Utah, middle class background, upbringing, expectations. This would have been in the very early 1960s.
What kind of a student were you?
Studenting wasn't my very best thing. I was distracted by the things that 16-year-old boys are distracted by.
16-year-old girls.
That would be the ear of the girl in the chair in front of me in class was far more interesting than what was ever on the blackboard. So I was, at best, a C student.
Okay. Were you athletic as a kid?
No, definitely not.
Okay, well, as everyone's going to see in the next few minutes, things changed in both of those areas very, very pronouncedly. So, why don't you go into your contributions to the space race and what happened when you were 17?
Well, this was a time when 16-year-old boys were interested in only two things, girls and the space race and becoming an astronaut. So on one May Saturday morning in 1962, I was building a rocket which exploded in my hands. That injury left me blind and with six of my fingers missing and assorted other scars from shrapnel. So I spent the next 7 weeks in the hospital in Salt Lake recovering from what ended up being 25 surgeries.
Wow. I would assume 17 years old, you were either a junior or senior in high school.
That's right, junior.
Junior in high school, and this definitely would be a major life-changing experience. Would I be safe in assuming that there was a whole lot of why me and a whole lot of depression going on while you were sitting in that hospital?
No, there wasn't, because I didn't realize how seriously injured I was. So I was determined to heal and progress. I would have died, except our next door neighbor happened to be an Army MASH surgical nurse and happened to be collecting in her laundry, which was out on the line to dry. And she appeared instantly, and her laundry became the bandages and tourniquets that kept me from bleeding out. So there wasn't at that time a lot of whining or depression. Some of those things came later. Whining has such a low rate of return.
I didn't say whining. I said why me-ing.
Oh, why me? Yeah. Oh, well, sure, there's that. But that's because I wasn't a rocket scientist.
So the young lady...
Very simple answer to that.
There you go. So the young lady next door, that's the ultimate being in the right place at the right time situation.
Absolutely.
So I'm gathering your family. You were the only one home when this happened? Your family wasn't around?
No, my mother was there, and one of my two sisters was home. The other sister and brother were elsewhere. I don't remember where they were.
But having a nurse at hand.
But the nurse is really to take charge. I mean, you know, she was army trained, and so she ran the first responders initiative, and went with me in the ambulance to the hospital.
Yep, that's your poor mother was probably hysterical and wouldn't have known what to do to help. She'd have been so upset. So you were so fortunate.
Yeah, that's right.
So we got out of the hospital after 7 weeks, and we don't see anymore, and we have four fingers?
Yes.
Okay. So what was your senior year of high school like? I assume you had to go back and finish.
I did finish, but really sort of as a charitable gift. I wasn't completely blind from the accident, but I lost my sight just as school started in the fall. And so I spent the next 6 months in San Francisco having an additional four eye surgeries, which obviously failed. One day the doctors came to my hospital room and said, you know, we've done all that we can for you, and you will be blind for the rest of your life. The mother obviously burst into tears. This wasn't a great surprise, but on that very day, I made the declaration that I wouldn't live as though I were blind, and that I would live and be in the sighted world and do sighted things, and not be dependent and poor and a burden.
That right self. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
That very same day. So after making that, what I now know is a declaration. And you know, declarations are the closest thing we have to magic. They change the future. So the very first thing I did, and that same day, was I applied to the guide dog school in San Rafael, and found myself within a very few months graduating from that school with the first of my seven guide dogs.
Have all of them been from the same school?
Yes.
And you find something that works, you stick with it.
Exactly.
I'm on my third dog from the CNI, so I can understand.
Mm-hmm. Well, it was also more interesting to go to California than to go to northern New Jersey.
No question about that. No question about that at all. So you've been pushed through charitably, as you said, finished high school, you have the dog, and where do we go from here?
Well, because I was a Utah citizen and with a valid high school diploma, even if it was a little fraudulent, the University of Utah had to take me, at least provisionally. So I started there that fall. The time when my seniors, my high school seniors were also starting. And I finished there 4 years later, which is how short it used to take, first in my class.
So you've gone from a marginal, bored, and couldn't really care less C student to the first in your class in college.
Yeah, that's right. I did that.
That's, if we don't go any further in this story, that in itself is a huge turnaround. Now that's long before the world had to provide adaptations, long before the ADA and long before schools had to do things for you. How did you work around the various issues of the blindness in your college classes? Did you have readers?
Yeah, no, it was way before Title IX of the Education Act, and of course way before Americans with Disabilities Act, which mostly I'm against. it's made things worse for many disabled people. I had volunteer readers. I had some readers that were paid, but I usually found volunteers, and I usually made an arrangement with fellow students that if we studied together, their grades would improve.
You help me, and I will make sure you do better.
Yes, exactly. So I, finished there in 4 years, and at that time, the new hot graduate school was a master's in business administration and MBA. So I applied to Harvard and Stanford, which were my first two choices. And Harvard sent my application and my $25 check. And back then, $25 was a lot. That was 500 gallons of gasoline.
We're talking about like 1967 or so?
Yeah, 67, that's right. So they said, look, nobody's blind could ever complete a program as difficult as ours. But Stanford kept the check but said the same thing. And I don't know how either of them knew that, because they had never admitted anyone who was blind, so they had no data on which to base this judgment.
Well, they were fine old institutions, and they knew better, and they weren't willing to take the chance.
Absolutely. They definitely knew better.
So you did find somebody who was willing to take you, though?
Yeah, the Wharton School. I went back and met with the dean, and he said, and I told him truthfully what had happened at Stanford and Harvard, and he said, I have no idea if you'll be able to make it here or not, but you're admitted, and we'll find out, and if you can't do the work, you'll just leave.
That's pretty simple. They gave you the chance, and it was like, show us you can do it.
Yeah.
In reality, I'm not really clear on this, but in business, doesn't Wharton carry a little bit more weight than the other two? A degree from Wharton?
I think they're roughly equivalent now. In finance, which is what I was in, Wharton is probably better known than the other two.
That's what I meant.
They're roughly equivalent.
Okay. We're talking about as good as it's going to get.
Yes.
Okay, so now we are... you weren't first in your class again, by any chance, were you?
I'm sorry?
You weren't first in your class again.
Oh, no, I was not. I slipped to fifth.
Oh, you should be ashamed.
That's what my mother thought.
Can't please them no matter what.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, so we've got a master's from one of the most respected colleges in the country, possibly in the world. Fifth in your class. You've got your dog. Obviously, life is looking good right at this point.
I would have thought that. It was, at that time, my peers at Wharton, it was easier to get a job than a credit card. And it wasn't hard to get a credit card.
Okay.
But they were getting unsolicited requests for interviews for jobs. I had 49 interviews and got 49. Well, we think you'll do great, but not here.
They just didn't know what to do with you.
They just didn't.
I've experienced that in my life. I've never achieved anything as close to what you have, but there have been instances where people just went, I just don't know what to do with you. And you can't really blame them if they have no life experience with it, but it would be nice if they gave us a chance to prove it.
Well, it really would be, and of course now, with the passage in the 80s of the Americans with Disabilities Act, it's even harder for seriously disabled people to get that first job, because it's very difficult to fire somebody who's disabled. it's much easier to never hire them. And it's very hard to prove discrimination on a hire. You know, they interview many more people than they're gonna need to fill the job. They pick the best ones. And who can say the reason you weren't picked is because of some discrimination against a protected class? It's a high burden of proof, but it's a powerful incentive to not be hired. And the data support that. The unemployment rate for the seriously disabled has increased dramatically. It's now over 75%.
You are the first person that I have spoken with that has negative feelings about the ADA. In my personal experience, not in an employment situation, but just in situations dealing with theaters and venues and restaurants, before there was an ADA, I could ask for something and generally people were very nice about it. You know, better seats for a show that I wanted to sit up close since I had limited vision. Now that there's an ADA, there are a required, obligated number of seats. This is the law, this is the rule, and they do what they have to do rather than doing what they thought was a good thing in the past.
That's right. And in most states, state law supported doing the right thing, particularly with respect to access. If you had a dog guide, and most restaurant owners understood that these dogs were permitted in restaurants, they're not pets. So ADA, of course, stiffened that, those penalties. It was state law well before ADA passed.
That I didn't know, but it doesn't surprise me. Okay, eventually, you say 49 interviews and 49 refusals. Eventually, somebody hired you.
Oh, yes. A little firm called Cook & Dealer is a very small investment firm in Philadelphia. And one of my classmates had gone to work there, and he recommended me to the senior partners. They interviewed me, and one of them, James McClellan, Jamie, said, you know, we're in the investment business, we ought to take a risk and invest in this guy, and we'll pay him the standard MDA starting salary, which at that time was $15,000. That would be a year, mm-hmm. not a month.
Of course.
And he can hire his part-time sighted assistant for about $3,000, and we'll see if he can do analysis.
So they gave you the opportunity.
We'll see if, you can't see the present, but we'll see if you can see the future.
So they gave you the opportunity, but really didn't give you any accommodations. They said, here's the job. You're going to need somebody with some eyes to help you do certain things. That's your responsibility.
Yep, you find her, you make the arrangement, you pay her, and we need a larger office so she can sit in with you.
So the bigger office was the only accommodation then?
That was the accommodation, yep. And they were pretty good about it. Now that would be an improper arrangement now that ADA has passed.
That's right.
Because they also said, you know, we'll try it, and if it doesn't work, we'll end it.
And today, they couldn't do that so easily.
They could not. They would expose themselves to an EEOC suit from someone like me.
Mm-hmm. And the world has become so very litigious that...
Yes, absolutely.
Okay, so obviously you finally got a position. Small firm, but there's nothing wrong with a small firm. Small firms get bigger.
Well, yes, and as you know, that one did. It got dramatically bigger.
So I'm sure that annual salary jumped a little bit over the years. You were not at $15,000 a year anymore, I'm sure. Things went well.
No.
How long did you stay with that firm?
I stayed with them from 1969 until about 20 years, till the late 80s.
Wow. Talk about job security. We'll see how this works out for a couple months, turned into 20 years.
Mm-hmm.
Excellent. Well, sounds like you were headed in the right direction. You had the job. You knew what you were doing. You obviously were very, very sharp, or you wouldn't have managed the placings in your college education that you did. Where did the when did the exercise come in? When did you, were you a physically active person? What was your life like outside the office, 69, 70, around then? What were you doing?
Steve was my, one of my fitness trainers. I had some other trainers before Steve, but Steve was training my wife, and he said, look, I want to make a proposal. You need to train 3 days a week. I was just turning 40 at that time, so you need to train 3 days a week. I'll pick you up at your house at 5:30 in the morning. We'll jog a bit, then we'll go back to the gym, work out, and then I'll bring you back home in time so you can shower and get to work. I said, Steve, you're not offering to train me. You're trying to change my whole life. He said, you've got it figured out exactly right. That is what we're going to do. We're going to change your whole life.
Okay, well, you just took a 20-year jump on me. You said you were 40 when you and Steve first started, and who he's talking about is Steve Maxwell, who has been a longtime friend of Russell's, who there is a very lengthy, very entertaining interview that I did with a few weeks ago elsewhere on the site, and I'd really strongly suggest you check it out. It's very long, came out in two parts, a lot of good information, and it's just entertaining. It was a lot of fun for me to do. So let's go back a little bit. You started with Steve when you were 40, and you're talking about your wife. You've kind of done a big jump ahead here. Let's talk about what you physically were doing with your life outside of work before you started working with Steve. Were you a physically active person, or were you just strictly the financial business wizard who did his work and...
No, I joined some foo-foo health club and used to exercise a couple of times a week, but not very strenuously.
Mm-hmm. And then it changed dramatically.
Now, as you know, Steve, nobody does any light exercise around Steve.
No. If you're going to work with Steve, you're going to be putting your all into it.
That's right.
But on the same on the other side of the coin, he's going to give you everything he's got as well.
Absolutely.
Okay, so initially it started...
You know, I was doing some... in the winter, I'd do a little bit of snow skiing, but I didn't have any sports that I played. And as I said, I did have these sort of higher-end exercise clubs.
Okay. Downhill or cross-country skiing?
Downhill.
How did you get into that? I mean, there's a lot of blind people skiing now, but how did you get into that back in the 60s, 70s?
Well, I've been a skier before I was blind. In fact, that's part of the reason my grades weren't very impressive.
Okay.
I just continued it after.
Ah. So then when I asked you if you were athletic... Then the answer is yes, you just weren't into school sports. You were a skier all along.
Well, that's right. I didn't play any school sports.
Right. Okay. I tried it once. I loved it. I'd like to try it again. Kind of scary at first, but...
It is. Yeah, that's right.
I just don't think I'd enjoy cross country. But downhill, when I first started leaning forward and started going, I was like... Oh, God. But this is fun.
Yeah. No, it is. It is fun.
It really is. Do you still ski?
No, it's too cold.
Okay.
So no, I don't. And I've discovered jiu-jitsu, which is which I like much, much better.
Okay, so we started with your wife had ended up in Steve's personal training facility, and you knew him through your wife, and then he twisted your arm, so to speak, into working with him.
Starting with exercise and then ultimately
right.
jiu-jitsu.
Right. No, I just wanted to get the background before we got to the jiu-jitsu, because he had mentioned that because of the condition of your hands, he had to get kind of creative with what he could do with your workouts. Obviously, you couldn't hold couldn't hold a dumbbell or a kettlebell in your hands real easily.
That's right.
So I'm guessing you did a lot of machines and a lot of body weight stuff.
Yes. Yeah, a lot of Nautilus-type machines back then.
Mm-hmm. So how long were you with Steve before he got the ingenious idea that we needed to turn this blind guy with four fingers into a martial artist?
Oh, at least a year, maybe longer.
And how did all that come about?
Well, Steve, you know, I ran out of excuses. Steve kept telling me that I would love it, that it's not at all what I thought, that it's a three-dimensional chess game in which strategy trumps strength and skill exceeds size, and that it would be perfect for me. And he was completely right. So he started me, and he was my teacher for years. There's a 2-minute video on YouTube that's not done by Steve. Steve was off traveling the world when this was made last year. But one of the trainers under Steve, a guy named Phil Migliorese, made the video. I still train with Phil sometimes when I'm in Philadelphia. But Steve got Phil started in jiu-jitsu, and they worked together for many years.
I get the feeling he's touched a lot of people's lives, both with training and with martial arts.
He certainly has. And his son, who is, in his low 30s, is one of the best Brazilian jiu-jitsu fighters in the world.
I suppose this is probably an inappropriate question to ask, but who's better, father or son?
Well, you know, I don't know.
They're both good.
They're both incredibly good. Zach has a very subtle style.
Okay.
I think Zach's going to end up being better. He was born in the gym.
Well, yeah, it's in his blood. Because wasn't Steve's ex-wife also into BJJ?
Yes, absolutely. She also is a black belt.
Okay, so Zach has definitely got it in his genetics.
He really does. And he was, as a gym rat, from birth. He was in there all the time.
I can think of worse, much worse places to grow up than in a gym.
Absolutely. And he's a fine, ethical young man.
Okay. So obviously, you gave in to Steve, you started training, you obviously flourished in it. Now, my understanding of BJJ is a lot of chokes, a lot of joint locks, arm locks, a lot of things that require grip. How did you overcome that?
Well, I have grip on one hand. And I can, for example, when I'm doing an arm lock, I can use both that grip and I can pin the wrist with my left arm. Also, I fight a lot with my feet and legs.
Ah, okay.
There are lots and lots of locks and chokes that are done with the legs.
Ah, okay. Steve had made
arm lock that's done with the legs. There's a a triangle choke hold that is involves fighting your legs against your opponent's neck. And believe me, my legs are stronger than almost anyone's neck.
I would assume so.
Mm-hmm.
Steve actually said that you kind of had the advantage because of the lack of development in your forearms because of your injuries. He said you had the boniest forearms in the world, and when you'd get him into a choke, it really, really hurt.
Yeah, he's right about that there. Yeah, my forearms are very bony. They make excellent
weapons
for chokes.
So you worked your way up into the ranks, up to your black belt, and you've obviously, to get that far, you've had to compete in some tournaments. And
yes.
So where did we go with the tournaments?
Well, I won the U.S. National in my weight division first, and then my coaches. I'd left Philadelphia, so I had other coaches than Steve. But they convinced me, and with Steve's encouragement and DC's encouragement, to go to the World's Master Senior Division in Rio de Janeiro. So in 03, I went and won a gold medal.
Not too shabby.
And a silver in the unlimited weight division, but in my division, a gold. And a lot of people thought that was kind of a fluke or something that couldn't be repeated. So since I was one of the people who thought that, we went back in 04 and 05, and I picked up two more gold medals and another silver and a bronze.
Not too bad. And
no, not bad. And then I decided I better retire while I'm this far ahead.
Yeah, you quit while you're on top.
I thought I'd better. You know, I was 3-for-3, no serious injuries in competitions, and and I was topping out at the top of the age bracket.
Was there another age group for you to go into then?
No, I would need to be fighting younger people, and which mostly I had to do anyway. When I won the U.S. Nationals, I had to fight somebody 13 years younger.
Okay.
So this wasn't anyone. There wasn't anyone in my age group.
Okay. So you, after that third World Championships, you decided it was time to hang it up as far as competition goes. You still practice.
As far as competition. Yeah, no, I train twice a week.
Have you ever done any teaching?
Some, definitely. Once in a while, I'll do a seminar. I don't have regular students.
Mm-hmm. Let's do a quick jump. What number dog are you on today? Are we still have a dog?
I don't have a dog at this time. I have had seven, but my last one retired and has gone to live with my son in Philadelphia. And we live kind of in this semi-rural area. When we move back to a city, I will probably get another dog.
Okay. Are you familiar with, this is an interesting thing, a gentleman in England recently started a self-defense program for the blind that he has been heavily promoting. Do you have any knowledge of that?
None at all.
Okay. I'm just very curious because he's coming to South Florida in November, and I'm toying with taking his certification to teach it.
Mm-hmm.
Very curious to see what it is, because he's emphatic about it not being martial arts. It's purely self-defense for the blind.
Well, as Steve, I'm sure, said, and I will confirm, my big limitation in jiu-jitsu is not being blind. It's the lack of grips.
Mm-hmm.
That's far more of an obstacle than lack of sight.
like I said in the notes of Steve's interview when we were talking about you on the page, I put, being blind was not the main problem with this gentleman. That's the easy part. No,
in fact, Steve used to train our team in a windowless room with the lights off.
Yeah, he had mentioned that.
He said, you know, we're all going to learn to have a better kinetic sense and feel where your opponent is.
Well, I've known of a lot of blind judo players, and I would think jiu-jitsu would be the same thing. I just don't see blind and karate, the kicks and punches.
No, no, none of the striking arts are going to work for people who are blind.
Is anything, once you get your hands on somebody, that's it? Then we're on equal ground.
That's right.
Okay. So you've pretty much told us what you think about the ADA. Did you have some activity, some involvement with the ADA or something similar to that at one point that you got?
I was one of the U.S. Commissioners for Civil Rights at the time when the ADA passed. I was definitely connected to it and aware of its misuse.
Okay. And that's why you, then you got a real close-up view of the details and the specifics, and you're definitely speaking from life experience when you say you feel it's a bad thing.
Many aspects of it are.
The intent is good, but there's a lot of good intentions
exactly.
In the world.
There are lots of good intentions.
Well,
that go wrong. Yeah, there are many unintended consequences when government acts.
Okay, just do a quick jump. You did 20 years with a firm in Philadelphia. The firm you're with now, you've been with for a very long time.
It's my firm. It's called Kairos Capital Advisors. We manage money on a discretionary basis. We advise wealthy families on a non-discretionary basis. And we write a weekly financial investment newsletter.
Okay, well, we had to put the plug in there, and I will definitely put your website address on the notes page for this, as well as trying to find the link. Is it under your name, the YouTube link you mentioned?
Yes, both are under my name. The 2-minute video on jiu-jitsu, which is it's a voiceover narration, and then of course the
TED Talk,
the TEDx Talk.
Right. Now I'm more interested in posting the jiu-jitsu. I mean, the other one is excellent, but the jiu-jitsu, let people see what you have done, what you can do.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so you've got your own firm. You're obviously very successful, 3-time world champion. I'm going to kind of put you on the spot here. You've accomplished a lot in your life, and I like what you said in the beginning where you decided you were not going to live in the blind world. You were going to live in the sighted world and live a more normal life.
Yes.
A lot of my readers are visually impaired. What would you like to say to them?
Be all you can be. Don't believe the narrative that the American culture gives you when they say you can't because. What I found is when people can change their narrative, they can accomplish almost anything. And that applies to all of us, not merely those who are limited physically. But if ever you have a narrative that says you can't because you're too young, you're too old, you're too thin, you're too female, you're too fat, those are disabling narratives. And ask yourself the question, who said that anyway?
You can't because somebody said so.
The authority to say that. And what if they're wrong? And how can I prove them wrong? So, my advice to all of us sighted or unsighted, is don't listen to those disabling narratives. If you do, you'll make them come true.
Self-fulfilling prophecy.
Absolutely.
You know, that looks like a great place to end this, unless there's anything else you'd like to say.
No, I think that is my... That's the just one thing of my life, is don't believe disabling narratives.
Okay.